Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to your car, do you get a second opinion? How about your house? Do you get a second opinion before getting work done? So why not when it comes to your own body? Why do patients forego second opinions when it comes to medical advice? And should doctors do more to encourage this? Joining us on the line for his take on this and other medical headlines is medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He also is the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Good morning, Art.
Good morning. I wonder if we should get second opinions about listening to this, but go on.
I think we probably wiser not
That's
to,
right.
actually.
That's right. Well, Art Kaplan, I was stunned when I read this story that this Gallup poll, it's a few years old, but still 2010, says 70% of us do not get second opinions, and even with pretty dramatic things like getting an angioplasty. So what's that about?
Well, first of all, it's very important to think about second opinions when you're going to undergo major diagnostic testing or major interventions, radiation, surgery. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I think part of the reason it doesn't happen is people are a little embarrassed. They don't want to alienate their doctor.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a trust issue. You know, you're sort of like, I'm going to second guess you now with somebody else because I don't really trust your opinion 100%.
Yeah.
That's tough. You know, who wants somebody operating on them when you said, you know, I don't trust you. So I think that's a problem, although it's one we ought to overcome. The right doctor should never be afraid of a second opinion. If they are nervous about it, I think that may be a sign that that's not the right doctor. There's nothing wrong with getting another view, very important to do. The other reason, Marjorie, is it's expensive. You know, you go for a second opinion, you got to pay for that. So I think that discourages that sort of thing. Insurance companies don't say, oh, yeah, we'll reimburse you for the second opinion. They don't like that.
Wait a second. On that note, they don't reimburse for second opinions for the most part?
They don't.
Was it only special cases? You have to make a request or something?
Exactly.
Well, that's
so
a good
that's routine.
All right, I figured most people were sneaky about it. They go off and get a second opinion and not tell Dr. Number One.
Some do. That's absolutely right. Some do. I think still, if you want to be able to come back and say, look, I talked to somebody else. It can't be too sneaky for long. And they said, you know, let's do watchful waiting or let's see how this goes. At some point, you got to come clean. So, look, at the end of the day, medicine is trying to be a science. Science means you seek out opinions based on evidence and people can disagree. It doesn't mean that everybody has to agree. That's sort of religion or ideology or something. And you got to kind of suck it up if you're a doc and be ready to hear what your colleagues think. I think that's crucially important. Now, if it's just a way to avoid something that you don't want to do, that's not a great reason to seek a second opinion. But if there's genuine uncertainty, somebody says, gee, I don't know, your prostate, maybe we should take it out, maybe we shouldn't, I don't think there's anything wrong with getting another view.
You know, not only do I not think there's anything wrong, I can't believe people don't do it all the time. And I have to say, by the way, in this story in the Globe last week, which reflects that poll from a couple of years ago, it says people do it, that 70% number holds pretty tight, even with people for whom the first opinion is from a doctor they don't know. It's not like they want they're worried about offending. And I have to say, I'm not surprised about this at all, because it's a topic we've discussed with you a lot through the time with you, Art Kaplan, is people are intimidated by doctors. I love the set of doctors I've had, and I've had quite a few, as Marjorie will note, in recent times.
Dozens.
No, I do. I really love these people. But it is an intimidating thing. I can't imagine any other consumer, for lack of a better word, transaction where I wouldn't get a second or third opinion. But with a doctor, there's this thing that is just different. And it seems to me that
it's even weirder, because I think what goes on is the doctors of today are the descendants of the priests of yore, you know, the people who were hanging around Delphi or transmuted metals and this sort of stuff. We want to believe they're right, because when we're facing illness or the risk of something that's life-threatening, you want to put your trust in a priestly figure. Arguing with the priest, probably not a good idea. Divine retribution, straight to hell, these kinds of problems begin to occur. So, you know, I think there's partly deference to the expert, but there's also, we don't want to undercut that magical power. And it seems that if we asked a second opinion, their ability to heal us might go away.
By the way, it depends on the priest in answer to responding to your...
That's what he's been doing in his off hours.
One last thing here, Art, though. It seems to me, and this gets to an ethical issue, I think, which is right in your bailiwick, is I think doctors should be either encouraging, or maybe encouraging is too strong a verb, at least suggesting that if you want a second opinion, feel free to do it. And by the way, it will not hurt my feelings. It will in no way affect the care I give, et cetera.
100% agree.
And why don't they? Or I know some do, but why don't they as a rule?
I think a few do, but as a rule, I think what they're saying is, I'm an expert. I've got my specialty down. I deal with your kinds of cases all the time. I know what I'm doing. So they don't normally sort of send out for other opinion. They're kind of entrenched, because many of the people you're seeing with these serious illnesses, they are experts, and they have seen these cases again and again. Still, just for informed consent reasons, if there are four ways to deal with your breast cancer or your prostate cancer, I think you ought to know them all. And I do think that it would be ethically sound to say, look, this is how I treat these things. Other people have different views. If you want to talk to other folks, here's their names.
We're talking to our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Art, I want to talk to you about this measles outbreak. It's mostly in California. Not that many cases, seven states, Mexico and California, only 87, so it's not huge. But still, this reflects – it started at Disney World, by the way, out there, Disneyland, excuse me. This reflects this idea among certain people, and they're well-educated people too, that they shouldn't vaccinate their kids.
And the resistors, or the anti-vaxxers, as you say, Marjorie, they're in the well-educated suburbs and neighborhoods. If we were in Massachusetts, we'd find them in Concord and Weston and up in Cape Ann. You know, it's not folks who are poor and illiterate. Their vaccination rates very good. They get the message. I shouldn't even say the word illiterate. They're listening. They're educable. So it's the people who are going to say, look, I don't vaccinate you. I don't put anything impure in you. I have you on the all-kale diet all the time. That's the crowd that's not vaccinating. So I don't know that you're going to get at them by education. I mean, who doesn't know at this point in time that there's a big measles outbreak caused by non-vaccinators, a pocket of them? Measles is highly contagious. That is, unlike Ebola, one you can get by being in the room after someone with measles has been there. I don't think this epidemic is over yet. So here's my recommendation, and all libertarians, fasten your seatbelts. I think we ought to try to sue somebody if you made my kid sick and they suffered or died. That is to say, sure, you can choose not to vaccinate, but why should you be free to omit the consequences if your kid makes my kid sick?
You know, I am with you. This, I mean, I get, and a lot of mothers I've heard, you know, written stories about this, they're upset because they used to wait a little bit longer to do these vaccinations. You know, it was used to be 2 months, now it's like 2 weeks, but that's not the measles. The measles mumps is usually given at 18 months, so it's well beyond. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I don't understand is the CDC says 94.7% of kindergartners in 2013-2014 school year were vaccinated. That's a pretty high percent, but it still leaves 6% or almost 6% that weren't. How do you get into school? I mean, in Massachusetts, you have
That's
to show your
point.
Vaccination record. And are they homeschooling, or who are, I mean, are they just ignoring?
Well, there are homeschoolers, but there are also exemptions. So it isn't that hard in Massachusetts or anywhere else to get an exemption. You basically sign a paper saying, I object on religious or philosophical grounds, and out you go.
Really?
Remember, too, yep. The exemptions ought to be tougher to get than they are. They're relatively easy to get. And let me add, in terms of religious exemptions, I don't think there are any real religious exemptions except maybe Christian Scientists. All of the major religions, their key books and tenets were issued long before vaccination appeared, so I don't say anything about it. It's not like that makes any real sense. But putting that on the side, the other problem is the measles vaccine is only about probably 90-92% effective. There are people who get it who don't build immunity, so you need to have everybody get it so the measles doesn't jump from person to person. So even if you're vaccinated, it's not 100% effective.
Wow, I am just stunned that this has to do with autism too.
That's where it all started, isn't it?
Right?
Yeah. So this was this goofball Andrew Wakefield who wrote a paper many years ago saying he saw a connection between autism and, in particular, this measles, mumps, rubella vaccine.
Right.
All disproven. license taken away. It's all nonsense. There's no connection between this vaccine. As you pointed out, Marjorie, the vaccine is now often given after the diagnosis of autism takes place. So that's a pretty good refutation, if you will, that it's causing it. And the rates have been going up, and vaccination rates are stable. So whatever's happening, autism isn't being driven by vaccination. There's not more vaccination, and there's more autism every year. So putting aside why that is, there's no connection with the vaccine, but that myth lives on the internet, social media. I saw a guy on a major news network last night saying, you know, my parents are worried about diseases from vaccines, and he was hinting autism, and, you know, I'm a pediatrician, and I let them out. By the way, he turned out to be the doctor to Jenny McCarthy.
Oh, no. Oh, who's a big proponent of the don't vaccinate your children cause.
Correct. Yeah. So those myths, once they get going, they're really tough to stop. And that's why I think a legal case saying, look, choose not to do it, keep your kid at home, homeschool them, don't send them to a daycare center where newborns are, where moms bring their babies in sometimes because they can't even be vaccinated. You kill somebody, we're going to hold you accountable.
You know, speaking of lawsuits, Art Kaplan, here's another lawsuit those people should file after they're finished with that one. They should sue these nursing homes into submission. There's a story in the Times 3 days ago that put me totally over the edge. The headline is, to collect debts, nursing homes are seizing control over patients. And the bottom line is, I'll give the short version and then you'll either expand or correct me, is that when some nursing homes, obviously this is not everybody, when some nursing homes are worried that the debt is growing and that despite your best effort to pay the bill, you're falling behind, they file for guardianship over the patient who is there in the hopes that they can control his or her finances. The only reason they do that is not out of kindness or empathy, but because they want to make sure they get paid. I mean, it's one of these things where I feel like there ought to be a law, as they say. What's the status of this thing? Is anybody contemplating making this illegal?
So I don't know if anybody's contemplating making it illegal, but basically taking your patient hostage
yes.
is probably pretty unsound public policy. It's ridiculous. I find myself ashamed of our healthcare system. So you are not paying the bill for one reason or another, and they come in and take control of your grandmother, all rights and authorities. They basically either want the Medicare check or they want to be able to get at your bank account, but they're taking control of everything, including medical decision-making. So that's absurd. If we're going to have a system that says, you know, you got to pay your bills and all that, fine, then do the debt collection and
right.
do what you can. But don't give up control of the care of your loved one to some finance department in a nursing home. So nursing home care has been and remains troubled. It's just a troubled part of our healthcare system. And let me add, how much discussion did we get of long-term care, nursing home care in the health reform debate? To which I will answer, nothing. There's been no discussion of it. We've got an aging population. We've got to cover the cost of nursing home care and home care. We haven't spent 5 minutes talking about it.
Well, you know, this story talked about the monthly copay that this wife, whose guardianship was in dispute, was almost $5,000 a month, and that was only the copay. So who can afford, you know, $5,000 and $6,000 and $7,000 a month? I mean, how can these nursing homes survive if you're not dealing with a bunch of rich people?
Well, one thing would be helpful is to figure out where the prices come from.
Yeah.
I mean, why do they cost what they do? We haven't had, I mean, I guess you can charge whatever you want, but we haven't had much discussion of the pricing of long-term care. I think, again, it is a kind of inevitability that if you live long enough, you're going to need assisted living or nursing home care.
Yeah.
So it's not insurance. It's kind of you ought to be paying some part of your income into a fund to pay for your long-term care when you get to a certain age, kind of what we do with Medicare. So anyway, the whole system for long-term care, nursing home care, it's got to become part of our political discourse. And it's great to argue about what's going to happen to you in the hospital when you're acutely ill, but many more of us are going to wind up needing nursing home care, and we won't pay attention to it because it freaks us all out. We don't like it.
One last thing about this, and I know I have a hyperbolic side to me, but this is not hyperbolic, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong. This is bad for the physical and mental health. Forget fiscal health. of the people that they're going after. I mean, imagine an old person who's insecure about their life, their health, their family, whatever, finding out that the nursing home has all the power over their life when their husband or wife or children are still around. I mean, it seems – I mean, I hate to keep bringing up your experts. It seems to me borderline unethical.
Oh, it's past the border. We moved into the continent there. It is unethical. It's like,
although, on the other hand, I hear all these advertisements on the radio for these lawyers that say, that if your mother's going into a nursing home, we can still take care that they don't go after her house when she's in the nursing home. So again, you wonder how these nursing homes, since most people are not loaded, can afford to operate.
They take everything you have. They take your house. Unless you go to one of these lawyers, they take everything.
Lots of people do protect their house, or they give their house to their kids or something like that. So they have...
Right. So the whole... Here's another problem. The Medicaid program was created in Massachusetts to help poor people, but it's also full of folks who spend down...
Exactly.
...give their assets away and houses away so they can qualify for Medicaid to start helping them pay for nursing home care. If that's the system, I got to cheat using a lawyer... so I can hide my assets or get rid of them so I can basically cover my mother's nursing home costs. I wouldn't call that a system. I would call it a scam. You know, it's like the whole thing is rotten to the core. That's an area where we just don't pay attention because you say the word nursing home and people run over the hills. They run away.
Yeah, how do other countries deal? I mean, the conventional wisdom is that a lot of countries in Asia and elsewhere have far more respect for older people than we do in this society here. The highest profile quote I can think of in recent times is when you're ripe, it's time to go. do other Western nations, do other nations beyond ours allow this kind of thing to happen?
Well, it's complicated. Say Italy, Japan, there's still a strong notion that the family takes care of the elderly, particularly the women. They take care of the frail elderly. They stay home. They wouldn't put them in nursing homes. On the other hand, the burden is usually on the child or the daughter-in-law to worry about it. They're the ones who get stuck with that care, but that model's different. In Holland, there's a lot of home maintenance, more assistance in the home rather than institutionalized care, which sounds appealing to me. It's dealt with in a lot of different ways. And America has a special problem because it's got a big country with a lot of families scattered all over the place trying to manage somebody from far away.
Right.
The European countries, not as much. They're smaller and they tend not to be, you know, California to Massachusetts type problems.
Okay, now let's move to the topic we really want to discuss with you today. We have a question first. We're having a three-way conversation.
Mm-hmm.
During this conversation, while Marjorie and I could be sitting as we're speaking to you, we are not. We are standing. Are you sitting or are you standing, Art Kaplan?
I'm lying down.
Good for you.
Well, there is this research, which we've discussed this from time to time here. The conventional wisdom is too much sitting is bad for you. And then apparently more than half of an average person's day has been spent sitting, watching TV, whatever. But what this most recent research adds to this is many of us thought that even if we do a lot of sitting, as long as we're physically active when we're not sitting, that they sort of cancel out each other. But this suggests that there's only so much you can undo, that sitting in and of itself, no matter what you do with the rest of the time, if you sit too much, is bad for your health. You're buying in, I assume?
I buy in, but I find the whole thing beyond depressing. At least I thought if you wandered around, exercised, after a nice day of sitting, you would balance it out. This research suggests, nope, there's really a detrimental effect. There's some of us can stand doing our jobs, and certainly you could. There are these treadmill desks and other things that are around, but... a lot of folks are stuck at a desk in a cubicle. They're not going to be standing or doing whatever. They sit. That's the job. I can't tell you how dismally awful this study makes me feel. It's like, oh, no, just, you know, there's nothing you can do. So that's the way that study pointed. I still wouldn't cancel my health club membership. I still wouldn't stop my 20-minute walk or something. Let's hope that research is wrong. But it is certainly hinting that sitting ain't good. It's not good for us.
Well, you know what's a weird thing? You know, you always have these. We talk a lot about dieting on the show, and one of the things they always say in diets, you should sit down and you should enjoy your meal, and you shouldn't be eating on the run because you forget how much you eat. This thing is saying, you know, stand up while you're eating if you're snacking, not necessarily when you're having dinner with your family, but just stand up in the kitchen while you're eating your sandwich, which I think is just the opposite of what people say that are worried about losing weight. So.
Well, you know, one of the problems of health is at some point you also are in a trade-off. If you walked constantly and hunted your own food and grew it, you'd probably be healthier than we are.
Yeah.
But we all like our milk delivered, you know, at the grocery, and we're probably not going to go hunt the deer in the neighborhood to work off the calories. So you do make a trade-off. I mean, at some point you just start to say, you know what, TV, I like that. Loss of life, 2 years. Well, for reruns of Seinfeld, maybe.
You know, one last thing, though. The one place I have to disagree. Well, wait.
Standing up.
I agree with that. However, what they do suggest in the study, and I agree, there's certain parts of your day where there's really no alternative, but there are a lot of things. For example, in this study, or at least in the recommendations, they say, for example, if you're taking the T, instead of taking the first seat and elbowing out a little old lady who really wanted the seat to begin with, stand up. There are some offices where you can do a standing up. I'm not suggesting everybody should do their work on a treadmill. They have those kinds of machines.
Take the stairs.
Exactly. So the point is, if the study is right, and I know you find it depressing, and so do I, there are things that we are used to doing sitting which are not unpleasant, like doing this radio show, for example, standing up, right? I mean,
I'll give you a little equation. You probably, if you jogged, I think there were some studies that showed if you ran, I don't know, let's say 50 minutes a day, you would add a year of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds good, right?
Why not? Great.
Not that good.
But if you hate jogging, then all you've done is added a year of miserable life to your 50 minutes
yeah.
a day.
That's a great point.
So
exactly.
I'm all for standing, and standing sounds good, but if you really hate it, you're sort of, you know, I'm going to live longer because I'm standing, but boy, do I hate standing. That's what I meant when I said you got to make the trade-off.
Well, you know what would be interesting here? You know, it's one of these things where I don't know if this is a proper analogy to end this discussion, is just like Marjorie resisted but finally came on to this calorie count thing on fast food menus, I think it does affect behavior. If you knew that watching 8 hours of television, sitting it every day, took 1.5 years off your life on average, then you can make an informed decision, right? I mean,
well, not if you're still eating your Cheetos standing up. But yes, I get the point.
Yeah. I don't know. Sometimes I think that living a long time is overrated, you know, after this nursing home discussion. I mean, maybe we'd all be better keeling over at 75 or
that's
something.
That's an upbeat note. What's on the Everyday podcast this week?
Week we're veering off to a subject I know you two will feel very strongly about, and that is shutting down your city on basis of a forecast. So this is science, the uncertainty of the weather forecast. You guys get clobbered down in New York. We didn't, but we shut the city down. And as you know, there's a lot of second guessing about that. To me, I think it was prudent, and I have no issue, but lots of folks seem to be disagreeing. They are very unhappy that they didn't get to suffer like Bostonians did or people in Framingham.
Yeah, but let me just add one thing to your podcast discussion. I mean, I know I'm sure you've thought of this, is the problem, even though, as de Blasio has said, it's better to err on the side of caution, mm-hmm. there is a boy who cried wolf kind of thing. Next time he says the worst storm in the history of New York City, most people aren't going to pay attention, right?
Right. So I wouldn't say the worst storm in the history of whatever. I'd just say it looks like it's going to snow a lot, so everybody off the roads for the next 6 hours while we plow them. I mean, you don't have to go crazy. That's what they did here. I think it just could become part of prudent policy to say, you know what, big storm coming. Looks like the Cape and Boston are going to get whacked pretty hard. We're going to close the roads for 6 hours so we can get the plowing done. I don't understand why we haven't been doing that anyway.
You know, there was a time on CNN yesterday, I don't know what the ultimate outcome was, that the town in which you were born and grew up, Framingham, had the highest snow total, not just in Massachusetts, but of any community in America. Did you know that?
I did. I'm getting, you know, my parents are still there at 94 and 91, and I can tell you, inch by inch, I get the call.
You know, we have a word now that has been coined for the exaggeration of the snow, the snowperbole.
I like that. It's the hashtag.
You like that?
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, you like that. Or here's another one from our producer, snowverblown.
I like that, too. Art, great to talk to you.
Art Kaplan, thanks. Okay. Art joins us every Wednesday. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast, which is going to deal with the snow today. Coming up, we're going to ask you, based on our conversation with Art, are you going to start standing up for things like when you work or take the subway or watch TV? How are you going to respond to this new research about sitting being very bad for you? That is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.